It's time for our monthly media segment, Signals and Noise. It's a discussion segment about things happening on and in the media. And in a world of personalized media, there's always lots to talk about. And we do define media very broadly, taking in items about the media themselves and content delivered over a broad range of media, from virtual reality to books. Our regular guests are here from the communications faculty at Southern Oregon University, Andrew Gay.
Thanks for having us.
And Chris Lucas.
Nice to be here.
Back with us again. Why don't we start with one of the awards ceremonies, because we got the Oscar nominations coming up on Monday, but the Golden Globes, of course, took place already 3 days ago on Sunday. Mm-hmm. Was that 4 days ago?
Yeah, the more drunken, raucous Hollywood Awards.
It is sort of the rhythm to the season. It's like you get New Year's Day, you know, everybody recovers from that hangover, and then they move into the first Sunday after New Year's, and they get into the Golden Globes.
Yeah, I think, and Ricky Gervais came back this year. He was not there last year, right?
I think he was. He's been saying for 5 years or
okay.
something.
There was a year where he was off. But, uh-huh. And, you know, he goes after everyone, and a lot of people like that. And some people, particularly in the audience of the show, I'm sure don't. I think they're I saw a meme of Tom Hanks' shocked face at one of the jokes or something. But, and particularly in this show, he kind of went after Hollywood, political and social activism, which, I saw a lot of buzz both for and against that message. You know, people saying, yeah, tell truth to power, for the real truth to power, tell Hollywood to shut up. But then other people saying, well, actually, there's really important issues. Like when Russell Crowe's speech read by Jennifer Aniston called attention to what's going on in Australia, or, these different issues that are, that Hollywood has ability to sort of highlight. And I think it's always the same thing, right, is that, when we agree with a celebrity, we cheer them on, and when we disagree with them, we say, "Shut up, you're a dumb actor."
Shut up and sing phenomenon, as it's been known for several years.
Yeah, easy pickings generally, right? Mm-hmm. Celebrity culture, and then who are going after the people who then like those celebrities and so forth. It seems it's a very familiar pattern, and it just goes back decades. I always kind of enjoy it because the spectacle of these shows, because of the competition and the hype around it is very. Obviously, a manufactured moment. These are more important sort of TV moments for these networks. Draws large audiences. It's live. It's unpredictable. But that unpredictability is actually kind of interesting to me. You put people who've had a couple drinks on a microphone. These actors do. They're just people. They've got points of view, and interesting things can happen.
It sounds like you watch it like a sporting contest, though. You're not sure who's gonna get an interception.
Why not?
Or something.
Why not?
Uh-huh. Yeah, my favorite tweet about the Golden Globes was, I guess there was a shot at some point where it showed Tom Hanks and Colin Hanks sitting next to each other, his son, and someone said the shot of Tom Hanks and Colin Hanks together suggests there might have been a cheaper way to do the Irishman
instead of having to do the age advancing and retreating with the likes of Robert De Niro. It's funny that we ended up talking about Ricky Gervais before we talked at any awards, but he really became the single biggest thing of the show in the way he kept insulting the people, which of course people expect him to do. But this year when he said, "You know nothing about the real world," to to the folks in the audience, most of you spent less time in school than Greta Thunberg.
Yeah, I think there's always a. I think it's easy to say, right, that, I think it was, what's her name? Jane Lynch. Am I saying her name correctly? Recently went off at Elizabeth Warren on Twitter, for instance, because Elizabeth Warren had a line in the debate about, millionaires in wine caves shouldn't pick our next president. Mm-hmm. And then Jane Lynch went off saying, like, millionaires in wine caves have just as much say as the plumber who fixes my bathroom. And everyone was like... That's an example of a celebrity maybe coming across as a little bit out of touch. But we also have to remember a lot of these people, right? There's some truth to the starving artist. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are many of these people who came from working class backgrounds, have known severe poverty, have known really tough lives before being where they're at now. So I do think there's always that balance to recognize that, just because someone is living in the lap of luxury and has a lot of success now, it doesn't mean that they don't know what it's like to be in a different position.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I think, one of the highlights of that show actually was Awkwafina's award. Awkwafina, mm-hmm. A daughter of an immigrant Chinese family, really comes an interesting kind of celebrity. Comes out of YouTube and then is in music and then into television and then film and
right.
very much crosses and these boundaries.
And in her speech said, you know, Daddy, see, I told you I'd get a job.
So she was the first Asian winner in that category?
Yeah, best actress.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. Best actress. So let's look at some of these because as I go down the list, we've gotten to the proliferation of so much stuff in television in particular that it's hard to know where to even find this stuff. You know, Rami Youssef got the winner for best actor in a television series, musical or comedy for Rami.
I don't know.
Okay, yeah. So I'm looking at both of you. Yeah, Andrew, I expect
I had not heard of that one either, yeah.
Best performance by an actress in a television series, musical or comedy, Phoebe Waller-Bridge in Fleabag, which is on Amazon Prime. I have seen both seasons of that, which I thought it was wonderful. Best performance by an actor in a television series, drama, Brian Cox in Succession. Wait, that's HBO, right?
That's HBO, yeah.
Okay.
Right. I mean, that's another one of those things about all these award shows, though, right, is one of the big critiques about them is that they award all the stuff that the average audience member has never seen. You know, it's a lot of elite television or the Oscars. It's you know, the more elite movies. They're not awarding the big popular popcorn stuff. They're not awarding the CBS sitcom, you know, that kind of thing. And so... you know, I think there's always that tension between, you know, what's really popular, what's critically loved, and now with our media landscape, with so many different streaming platforms, you know, how do you find the stuff? But I guess that's also the value of these award shows for the producers, right, is that this is an opportunity for someone to say, well what the heck is Fleabag? Maybe I'll look that up.
Yeah, or I could drive some people to see movies.
The Golden Globes has really been a lot more, I guess, media agnostic, we might say. Like, they've often kind of crossed these boundaries into television, film, and now... But where the Oscars has been trying to hold the line more, and that's been an interesting dynamic over the last couple of years, is like Netflix, you know, saying, listen, we're putting out movies. These are movies.
Right, and then The Irishman is a great example. That is a Netflix movie. And we were sitting around one day going, where can we see The Irishman? Oh, wait, it's on Netflix. And we started watching it.
Right, but even Netflix had to do a limited theatrical run to make an Oscar qualifying.
Right, that's right, that's right. Okay. Well, and one of the items on the list here was Best Motion Picture Drama went to 1917, which brings in a call from Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
Hi.
Good morning, panel.
Hi.
Good morning.
And the award for most awards goes to Netflix.
Yes, but
that wasn't what I called about. I wonder if anybody can recall back. There was a movie that Alfred Hitchcock did called Rope.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
and it was done in a cinematography style that you just thought it was this one seamless event after the other.
Right, yeah. Hiding the cuts.
Yeah, and I haven't seen 1917 yet, but yeah, maybe you guys could discuss that over the air, and I'll just hang up and listen.
All right, thanks, Jamie. Appreciate that.
Sure. I mean, I haven't seen 1917 yet either. Actually, Chris and I were just talking about the fact that it came out so while everything was going on over the holidays, and neither of us got a chance to see it. But my understanding is they did something pretty similar, right? Is that it's not actually a war movie done in entirely one shot. It is hidden cuts, so that it appears to be one long shot. But yeah, that's a technique that's been around since Hitchcock did Rope, and I'm looking forward to seeing how they pull that off, and I'm sure there's probably some extra digital elements and things like that Hitchcock would have loved to have had that we're not seeing.
That's really the new element, I think, is obviously the digital ability to stitch these pieces together. Back when Hitchcock does this, you know, what is a film reel is maybe 4 minutes or something, or maybe 10 minutes at the top. So you can imagine the amount of planning that goes in. And you watch that movie, you can tell.
Yeah, so you suddenly push on someone's back and then pulls out from someone's back.
Right, when you get behind the post and you go through the wall.
Exactly. Right.
Precisely. But also, so one of the other kind of new developments is with digital cameras, of course. You can just kind of, as big of a hard drive as you have, you just record the hard drive, right? So you can do just a longer take without, you know, those kinds of stitches.
Yeah, you don't even have to stop down. It's like, yeah, no, keep rolling. We're good. Yeah. Just call it another take. We'll keep rolling.
Which is a nightmare in grading, by the way.
Yeah.
From a story point of view, and again, I'm really, really excited to see this film because just that, the kind of story reasons for doing a single long take, of course, is that it just feels like, it's more like real life experience, right? We just kind of go through our life and events happen to us again. You know, we just, there are no breaks like that, I guess, until you go to sleep. But so it really changes just the way you tell the story.
This is Signals and Noise on the Jefferson Exchange. Chris Lucas and Andrew Gay back with us, and we're talking about items going on in the media. We'll move on now to talk about a couple of movies, specifically Cats and Star Wars. Could choose which one we talk about first. Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker.
The Rise of Skywalker came out. I mean, Chris, you saw it?
You had to go to Star Wars.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So.
I'll be honest. It left me a bit cold. I was not a raving fan. I didn't hate it either, but it did okay. But by Star Wars standards, it was a disappointment. I think a lot of the diehard fans saw it as more on target with what they wanted. But then there's a lot of also fans who were brought in. I think sort of newer Star Wars fans that were brought in by, for instance, new characters like Rose Tycho, played by Kelly Marie Tran, who were very disappointed and felt betrayed by some of what happened in the film.
Because she got very few lines.
Yeah, I mean, this is a major character in the last film who had less than 2 minutes of screen time, and I believe less screen time than Dominic Monaghan, the Lord of the Rings Hobbit and Lost alum, who got a cameo. A rather distracting cameo because he won a soccer bet with J.J. Abrams. And so, it's interesting that the writer, the co-screenwriter, has been on a little bit of an apology tour, kind of saying like, well, you know, we had a lot more that we wanted to show, but we thought about making it two movies. And, that's never kind of a good sign when you're having to really explain everything. But, I don't know.
It was obviously a very well made sort of thrill ride of a movie. I mean, and I will
non-stop
admit, I was very the final kind of spoilers when our heroes hug at the end. I was a little choked up. I've been watching Star Wars my whole life, so there's no doubt that sort of gets to me. But I did. I was not a big fan of sort of the reveal about Rey's main character. I thought that did a lot of damage to my whole sense of what the story was about.
We could all have our suspicions about that. Right. I got my own, too. Yeah. I haven't seen it yet myself.
We're trying to be spoiler careful.
Yes, I know. You're very very careful. Very much appreciated here. Yeah. But, yeah. I guess a question that becomes is, like, when you run a series out for as many – I mean, this is nine in the original three trilogies films, plus the additional ones like Solo and Rebel One. I mean, so you have all this mythology built up, and at this point, the audience – it feels like it owns it as much as the people who produce it do.
Yeah, and I guess that was actually, to me, the thing that I think nagged at me the most is that with this film, I mean, there's a lot of backlash between the Last Jedi, a lot of it coming from some very kind of sexist, misogynist, racist places that was really ugly. And in some ways, what I think most disappointed me about The Rise of Skywalker is that it felt like they really wanted to appease that audience, and that was disappointing. But the other thing that I thought was interesting, I mean, these are both Disney properties, Marvel and Star Wars now. Marvel, they have hit and miss movies, no doubt, but there's still that sense of like they have planned everything out and they are trying to connect them. And sometimes it goes awry a little bit, but
like any movie starring the Hulk.
But yeah, I mean, ultimately, these aren't auteur films. These really are Marvel films that are serving a greater purpose that they're doing. With Star Wars, The new trilogy really felt in a lot of ways like, someone that exercise you do in class is like write a sentence and see what the next person writes and pass it around. It did not feel to me like those three films were really fully planned out before they went into production. Now, of course, you gotta give J.J. Abrams a little bit of leeway here. Everyone knows that Carrie Fisher was supposed to be her film in a lot of ways, the way that Harrison Ford had the first film and Mark Hamill had the second one. And of course, she passed away, unfortunately. And so they had to scramble. He wasn't supposed to direct it. Colin Trevorrow was originally the director, and he stepped out. So, those things happen. But it did feel a little bit like, all right, so how does this connect to what came before?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're absolutely right about the investment that the fans have, not only across these films, but now with the animated series and the TV series and Mandalorian. Now, like, all these things are adding up. And I think I can imagine the challenge, for these, a much deeper challenge to me than Marvel, the fact that these writers are trying to navigate such a deep and world of storytelling that pre-exists them getting involved. Mm.
Signals and Noise on the Jefferson Exchange with Chris Lucas and Andrew Gay. So Cats now, the exact opposite of the buzz about Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker.
A phenomenal bomb.
Yeah. Our other student assistant mentioned going the other day, and she and her friends took up the only 5 seats occupied in the theater.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a whole thing online about people getting high on various substances and going to see Cats and then reporting their experience of that. So I think that's probably where they've made most of their money so far. But yeah, I mean, this is just a spectacular box office bomb, really kind of embarrassing for everyone involved. And it's hard to wonder why no one saw some of the trouble coming.
Well, especially when it seemed to have been voiced with the introduction of the first teaser trailer that people were freaking out about the crossover human cat look, which reminds me very much of how many people freaked out about the Sonic the Hedgehog movie.
Right.
When
right.
Sonic the Hedgehog
and they changed it, right?
Showed up with human teeth,
Sonic
which,
the Hedgehog.
Yes, they changed.
We gotta fix Sonic. They didn't fix the cats though.
Yeah. Well, that'd be a pretty tough fix, I guess. My sense is like it is definitely a bomb. Universal is a studio that put this out. Is a pretty disciplined studio. It was, you know, the budget was around $100 million, a little less. So it's made something like $60 million now. That's obviously not ideal. It's a big bomb, but it's not the biggest bomb. It's not the kind of bomb that takes companies out.
Mm-hmm.
It can definitely sideline some careers. Tom Hooper was the director of this. I think the reason that he kind of got free rein is, you remember he did Les Mis, which a lot of people were very skeptical about, mm-hmm. was, I think, a $60 million budget, and then that made like $500 million, that movie. So that kind of success.
It also had the benefit of a plot. But.
True.
Yes. Thank you, Victor Hugo.
That is, I think the one thing to think about is like Cats is a very theatrical experience. But I'm surprised anybody thought that was going to be a good movie.
Yeah, it's constantly made fun of by other shows, right. like Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt,
right.
Consistently made fun of Cats and the lack of a plot in there.
Right.
Let's take a call here from Don and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're still talking movies with Chris and Andrew.
Well, one of my favorite movies is, because I studied Russian and Russian history, it's called The Russian Ark,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's made with a single shot as you visit the Hermitage Museum, mm-hmm. in St. Petersburg, and everybody from Russian history just happens to be there on that one night for that one party.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you walk up, there's Rasputin, there's Catherine the Great, you know, oh, how are you, you know. And they rented the place for one night, and they had this very athletic German steadicam operator who got a leg cramp in the middle and had to be massaged as he shot.
Mm-hmm.
But it's you know, it's kind of a specialized movie, but it is one shot.
Yeah, right. Thanks for bringing that up, Don.
Legitimately one shot. Yeah, that one did it the old school way. Yeah.
I could just imagine the pre-prep you have to go through, and I imagine a couple of rehearsal runs too.
Yeah, I can't remember how many takes they did of that. I mean, I studied this film in college, but it's been a while since I've seen it. But yeah, I mean, it is pretty amazing to sit there and watch the choreography that went into doing something like that.
Yeah, there's another film, a very obscure film, but I was really fascinated by back in the same era, called Time Code, which the filmmaker did 4 simultaneous long takes that were 90 minutes long.
It's like split screen, right?
And it's basically 4-way split screen, and it's kind of a remarkable and slightly disturbing film to watch. He guides your attention just using the sound, because you're literally watching 4 windows on the world.
Is there a real artistic benefit to doing this, or is it more like, hey, look at what we did here?
It's a little gimmick.
a little bit of both, a little bit of showing off maybe, but you know, it was, I guess, the theme of the movie to some extent was about kind of the interweaving of these people's lives that kind of comes to a climax, and they all end up in the same room with all the perspectives together.
Right? Mm. All right, so you know, we could certainly talk about the serious stuff going on in the world of media, which is always
to?
Well, we don't. No, actually, we don't. Which is what I was going to say was, you know, I'm going to give you guys the rare benefit of having a minute and a half each to do your pick 3s.
All right, I'll let Chris go first.
Oh my gosh. Wow, it's been a kind of a hard month to really get into my...
Your pick 3 zone?
Yeah. I will say there was a great interview on Fresh Air yesterday with Andrea Bernstein, her book American Oligarch,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of a fascinating book looking at the history of sort of the Kushner and the Trump clans.
Yes.
I think that's really worth checking out. A big watch in our family right now is on Netflix called The Witcher.
Mm. The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher?
The Witcher. The Witcher. Okay. It's kind of a sword and sorcery.
Okay.
Pretty violent. Let me give a warning. Uh-huh. It's kind of in your Game of Thrones kind of category. Mm. And then I'm going to name two Netflix things, I guess, just because I realized that this month – one of my all-time favorite, guilty pleasure watches, a creature feature called Tremors.
Oh yeah, I saw that too. I saw it was on there.
Came to Netflix, and that is such a delightful, funny.
It is
sort of.
Oh, this is the underground thing.
Kevin Bacon, right?
The elephant
Kevin
guns
Bacon.
And all.
Was that?
Isn't Kevin Bacon in that one?
Kevin Bacon.
Michael
yes.
Gross. Yeah.
Michael Gross.
Yes. Long time ago. Yes. Wow. That is a guilty watching pleasure. All right. So what do we get here? Andrea Bernstein, American Oligarch, The Witcher, and Tremors for Chris. Andrew, what's your pick three?
All right. So first one was a film I watched with my family on Christmas Day, The Aeronauts on Amazon Prime. It's sort of loosely based on history. It is fictionalized quite a bit, but it's about the early sort of adventures of balloonists, and it's exciting and it's dramatic and has a really strong female character heroine, and my kids loved it. The second is I think this might be a record breaker for me. I'm recommending a book. I never recommend books because people probably don't think I read. Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens was a Christmas gift for my wife, and I'm really enjoying that. And then I want to give a shout out to my friends, local filmmakers, Gary and Annie Lundgren. Their film, Phoenix, Oregon, which premiered at the Ashland Independent Film Festival last year, just got theatrical distribution. And so it'll be coming to theaters near you very soon.
Okay, that's the bowling alley story, which, of course, because there's no bowling alley in Phoenix, had to be shot partly in Klamath Falls. All right, well, good to hear that the Lundgren's got a theatrical release on that. Okay.
Same.
All right, good list, as always, gentlemen. Good to have you both here, Andrew Gay and Christopher Lucas. Work in the communication faculty at Southern Oregon University, and join us once a month for a media overview we call Signals and Noise. Great to have you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
That'll do it for this hour of the Jefferson Exchange. We'll talk about digital trails for your kids coming up in hour number 2.